The first meeting of the Government Operations Committee of the 2019 session is in order here. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I'm Mike Freiberg. I'll be chairing this committee. This is my first time chairing a committee, so please bear with me if there's any growing pains from a rookie chair here, but I'll certainly do what I can. The first thing I would like to do is just have members and staff introduce themselves. What are we listening to over there?
Not me.
sounded interesting. I kind of wanted to hear what it was. just kidding. Why don't we introduce ourselves? We can just start with Amanda and go around here. Say where you're from and so forth, and all the usual stuff you do on your first day of a committee.
I'm Amanda Rudolph, and I'm the committee administrator, and I'm from Cottage Grove.
I'm Matt Gehring from Nonpartisan House Research.
My name's Representative Kristen Bonner. I'm from District 34B, Maple Grove and Osseo.
Nick Sterwas, State Representative. I'll be the Republican lead for this committee. I represent Elk River, Big Lake, and Otsego.
Dwayne Quam, Byron.
Representative John Heinrich, I represent the cities of Anoka and Ramsey, District 35A.
Steve Elkins, 49B, Bloomington, Edina, Eden Prairie, and Minnetonka.
Bob Vogel, I'm from Elko Newmark, and I represent District 20A, which is Southern Scott and Western Lee Sword County.
Nolan West, I represent Blaine.
Tana Tice, I represent 14A, which is the west and south part of St. Cloud, Wake Park, and St. Augusta.
Joe Marble, I'm the GOP research.
My name is Amina Safi, and I'm the DFL research consultant. I'll be working on this committee, state government finance, local elections, and government.
Gene Pulowski, there are many government operations stories, and perhaps the most curious one was the day a vote was taken, and it was a voice vote. There were no audible ayes. There were no audible nays. Mark Shepard was sitting there, and we actually had to inquire with Mr. Shepard what happens to that bill. He said, dies on a tie vote.
I'll make sure, for those not here, Representative Pulowski, we are very fortunate to have Representative Pulowski here. He's a former chair of Government Operations Committee.
Drafted, so be careful.
Yeah, so he's overqualified to be on this committee. Actually, we have two former chairs, I guess I should say, and along those lines next.
And Representative Nelson, I'm from Brooklyn Park, Senator House District 40A, and I former chair of this committee and learned everything I know about this committee from the gentleman to my left.
Well, and I learned everything about it from you during my freshman year. So there's a good chain of people here.
Hi, Representative Sandy Lehman. I'm sitting in a good spot because I'm new to the committee. This is my first opportunity to join you, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm District 5B, and that's much of Itasca County and parts of Cass County.
Good morning. My name is Leon Lilly, Representative. I represent three East Metro communities, North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale.
Good morning.
I'm Deborah Dyson. I'm from the Nonpartisan House Research Department.
Dwayne Selk, I'm from Northern Rochester, represent Northern Rochester, and I guess in the unfortunate opportunity that Mike does not show up, I guess then I get to be chair.
Nothing, as I know from my experience, my first term being vice chair under Representative Nelson, it's always totally smooth sailing when you fill in at the last minute.
I'm Colette Millard, and I'm the committee legislative assistant.
Okay. Thank you. And we have a couple new members here, too.
Hi, Aisha Gomez. I'm from 62B, which is South Minneapolis. Is that all I'm supposed to say?
You could say more if you want.
I don't know. I'm just excited to be here. Good to see everybody. Good morning.
Yeah, we're excited to have you.
Awesome.
Representative Lee from District 59A, this is my second term and second time serving on the Government Operations Committee.
We look forward to having you. So Before we get to the official business here, I know it's standard practice for members who are presenting bills at a committee for the first time to bring treats, so it seems only reasonable for a chair who's chairing a committee for the first time to bring treats. So I'll just set these around here. This is, I know Representative Zerwas, you think, don't expect this every time, but this is, So this is courtesy of Valley Pastries in Golden Valley, which is one of the finest bakeries in the state, as far as I'm concerned. So hopefully you'll enjoy those. They're very good. So while those are being handed around, and don't expect this every time, by the way, Representative Zerwas, but it seemed like we should start off on the right foot here. I sort of felt.
You've set the bar high.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, just save me one, please.
Mr. Chair. This morning when I came in, I overheard Supply telling somebody that new chairs were being delivered today. So hopefully soon we'll be able to get rid of these wonderful chairs that we have already.
It just keeps getting better and better on this committee as far as I'm concerned. the new chairs will be good. This is the committee hearing room with probably, for those who are new to this room, this chamber, this is the hearing room with probably the worst chairs. So hopefully we can impress upon the sergeant at arms that this hearing room should get the new chairs first. What's that? Oh, yeah, and you probably want to silence your cell phones, too. So, and sometimes, too, if you have them near the microphone, there'll be a buzzing sound. We are being recorded, so you probably want to keep them away from the... I know I'm setting a bad example here with my iPad, but I have some notes on it I kind of want to refer to during this hearing. So the first order of business is just the committee rules. You should all have these in your packet. They're pretty standard compared to other committees' rules. The one thing I think it's probably important to mention specifically is there is a 20. I guess we call them, if it's the day before, it's generally referred to as a 24-hour rule. I guess maybe it's more like a 19-hour rule, since number 8 here says to have enough, your amendments should be submitted by 3 o'clock the day before the committee hearings. So just so you're aware of that, it can be waived if it's a minor oral amendment and the committee generally agrees. We can certainly consider amendments along those lines as well, but general practice will be to have this 19-hour rule in place. Does anybody have any questions along those lines about the rules? Oh, we have a new member. So if you could please introduce yourself so we know who you are, and you'll want to make sure the treats find their way back to you also.
Representative Jim Nash, 47A, Western Carver County.
Yep. Thank you. My general hope for this committee, a lot of bills get referred to this committee. We will we'll be hearing from House Research shortly about some of the mandatory referral rules that the committee has. I did ask House Research for some data just about how many bills we could expect in this committee. I was only able to get information from the last session, but during that session, during the 17-18 biennium, 451 House files were referred to the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. At some point, 236 House files were heard by the Government Operations and Election Policy Committee. So, there's a lot of bills. We'll be pretty busy here as we get later into the session. It's certainly possible we will be meeting at night. It's certainly not my goal to do that, but we'll do what we have to get through our work. The first, the tentative plan here, we'll be hearing from House Research today, from the Department of Administration. The agenda still has OAH on it, but I think we actually changed that. Yes. I was maybe a little overambitious as a first-time committee chair and thinking we could hear from all sorts of organizations, from different organizations, but I'm trying to keep this. Okay, got it. Yeah, so. Yes, no, I was going to mention that too. And you'll see in your You'll see in your packets, too, there's also two House files there, House File 14 and House File 17, authored by Representative Nelson and Representative O'Driscoll, respectively. Those were referred by the infamous memo process to the Elections Subcommittee, which will be hearing it on Wednesday, and then pending referral from that subcommittee, we will be hearing it here on Thursday. We will be hearing both bills on Thursday as well. Next week, sort of the tentative plan is maybe to hear from the Legislative Pension Commission and possibly hear some bills, but we'll make sure you get at least a few days' notice about those as well at this point in the session. Does anybody have any questions about the plan going forward? Yeah, with over 400 bills referred to this committee last time, I don't expect we'll be able to hear them all, but I will certainly endeavor to hear as many as possible from both parties as well. I'm hoping not to do too many of these overviews. I'd kind of like to, we're a policy committee. The policy deadlines happen first, so I'd kind of like to just start hearing bills sooner rather than later if possible. So and hopefully we will start doing that on Thursday with the election bills, again, pending re-referral from the election subcommittee. Anybody have any questions? Okay, I guess with that, I'll turn it over to House Research. You're welcome to stay here, or maybe it's better, I suppose, to go up to the testifying table. And if you could just identify yourself for the record and sort of explain the – I've asked House Research just to kind of, talk about their role here, but also, what the mandatory referral process. This committee is a little different from some other ones in that for certain bills to get through, they actually not just should get referred to this committee but have to. So if you could just identify yourself for the record and take it away.
Mr. Chair and committee members, again, to introduce myself, my name is Matt Gehring. I'm from the Nonpartisan House Research Department. This will be my 13th legislative session here at the House. I started in 2006. In addition to this committee, I also staff the Election Subcommittee, then the State Government Finance Division.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Deb Dyson. I'm from the Nonpartisan House Research Department also, and I guess I started with the House in 1991, and I've covered metropolitan government on and off since then. Various other committees, but since 2000, capital investment and local government powers and duties.
Great. Thank you.
Then, Mr. Chair, just to refresh all your memories about our role in the process and what we do, both Deb and I are available to help you with drafting. So if this bill drafting and amendment drafting, if you have questions about policy items that you don't necessarily need to draft on, but just have questions about how some aspect of the law works within this committee's jurisdiction, we're able to help with that. In general, you're going to see me on days when there are bills that affect state government operations, and you'll see Deb on days where there are bills that affect local government operations. A third person who's not here at the moment, but you might see on occasion, is Ben Weeks. He's our employment analyst in House Research, and he'll handle the bills that relate to public employee contracts and labor negotiations to the extent that you have those. What we thought we would do, that there should be in your packet a memo that has the House Research logo on the top. This is a memo that Deb and I put together that basically outlines the general jurisdiction of this committee. The one thing that's sort of unique about this committee is that you have, as the chair already referenced, you have a pretty broad jurisdiction. And so what's going to happen is you're going to have lots of bills that get referred to your committee because of little aspects that are within the jurisdiction of what is called government operations. What government operations means is the structure and functioning of state government or local government as sort of institutional entities. So you're not necessarily looking at bills for particular policy outcomes. What you're looking for is to make sure that bills that are coming from other committees are functional in terms of how government is structured and how it works. So you're kind of reviewing bills to make sure that they can actually be operational if they get enacted. So the way that this jurisdiction is implemented is through a mandatory referral rule. This is House Rule 4.13. It's the top of the memo that you have in front of you. There's sort of three different types of bills that require referral to this committee as they go through the process. The first is requirement that bills that establish a department, agency, commission, board, task force, advisory committee, or council or bureau or other like entity come to this committee for review. And the reason why this rule exists is not necessarily just to have you decide whether it's okay for a group of people to get together and have a meeting to talk about something. What you're looking for in task force bills and these types of bills is to make sure that the organization that's being structured in the bill is actually functional. So it'll be questions like, does the open meetings law apply? Is there someone whose job it is to call everybody on the group to tell them to come to the meeting and reserve a room? Is there language in there about reimbursing task force members for their expenses associated with driving to the Capitol and attending a meeting, those sorts of things? Those are issues that the substantive committees, for example, if it's like a transportation task force or something, the transportation committee might feel very passionate about the policy that this task force is going to look at, but they might not necessarily pay attention to those sort of back office details about making sure the group can work. So that's all of your responsibility as the Government Operations Committee is to review those aspects of the bill. The next mandatory referral would be for a bill that delegates rulemaking authority to an agency or exempts an agency from rulemaking. I have a separate presentation that we can do at some point, either to the committee or individually for those who, if you'd like it, about what rulemaking is and how it works. I don't have that today. In general, what rules are pronouncements by state agencies that sort of make a general state statute more specific. So like an example of an administrative rule in my area that I deal with would be in elections, the Secretary of State adopts rules that govern the format of the voter registration application. So all of you set policy about what the registration requirements are for voters, and the Secretary of State has authority in law to then take those requirements and then figure out what the piece of paper should look like that's uniform across the state for people to register to vote. So that's it's a more detailed thing than the legislature usually deals with. But the agency needs to be authorized by law to actually set those rules. And so you're going to review bills that will be referred to you that authorize agencies to set rules. And what you're looking for on those bills is looking at whether it's appropriate for the agency to be setting this policy by administrative rule or whether the issue should be set by the legislature. You're looking for a balance between the length of time needed to adopt the rule. So if it's sort of an emergency thing or there needs to be a quick turnaround, you'd want to make sure that the rulemaking process is structured so that the agency can adopt a rule quickly. Or if it's a rule that's going to be more complicated and controversial, you want to make sure that the agency has enough time to actually implement those rules and write them. Sometimes rules can be done in 3 or 4 months, and sometimes they take several years. And so if you've got a deadline in a bill to adopt a rule by July 1st, you want to make sure that the agency can actually meet that given the requirements that they have to adopt the rules. Then the third mandatory referral is for bills that substantially change the organization of a department or agency of state government. So sometimes you'll see bills that transfer duties or responsibilities from one entity to another. So an example of this from last session was a transfer of what's called the State Historic Preservation Office from the Minnesota Historical Society to the Department of Administration. In addition to the sort of substance of what that office does, what you do is look to make sure that the human beings that work in that office and the records and papers that go with that office and everything else that goes with that office actually gets moved efficiently from one agency to another. So when you hear bills like that, you're looking to make sure that those things are taken care of. So those are the three mandatory referrals. As I mentioned at the beginning, as the chair mentioned, this is the aspect of this kind of jurisdiction that is in some ways out of your control. You're going to get a lot of referrals from other committees for little aspects of bills where you have to look at these things, and we can help you as the session moves forward to kind of identify the specific pieces of bills that would be within the committee's jurisdiction. I already mentioned rulemaking and that process a little bit. As I said, I'm happy to meet with anybody individually if you want to understand how the rulemaking process is structured and works. It's probably a little bit too much for sort of an introductory session here, but I'm happy to take questions if people have them, or I can go into more depth if you'd like at the end of the presentation today. As I said, the bills that relate to state agencies all come to this committee. State contracting bills, so to the extent that a bill is changing the way that an agency is required to go about letting a contract for goods or services, that would come through this committee. That's a sort of operational function of state government that is run through the Department of Administration. So you'd, in this committee, look at those bills to make sure that the procedures for contracting fit with your policy expectations and goals for state government. State employee compensation. This is another item that traditionally comes through this committee. So all the state employee unions negotiate contracts with MMB, and those contracts have to be ratified by the legislature. Typically, those bills that ratify contracts will come through this this committee first for review. Public pension policy also is something that comes through this committee. There is separately the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement that meets and does most of the heavy lifting on pensions policy. So last year there was a major pension reform bill that went through the Pensions Commission, then also came through this committee and was ultimately enacted into law. But you'll hear from the Pensions Commission, I think, at a later committee hearing to get a sense of what they do, and I would recommend their staff as a good resource for understanding how pensions work. And then finally, the sort of next piece of the jurisdiction of this committee is local government, and that's Deb's area.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Deb Dyson again from House Research. In the memo beginning on page 3, I cover some of the general topics related to local government that the committee might be looking at. The committee hears bills that are related to the governance, powers, and duties of local and regional government. And by regional government, one of the main ones would be the Metropolitan Council's governance structure. And then other committees probably are looking at in more detail at some of the powers and duties, particularly in the transportation area. The Transportation Committee would be looking at the council's role in transportation. But there are bills related to the overall governance structure of the council that have come through this committee and the local government subcommittee. Local government is not a defined term specifically for all purposes. So whenever a bill is referring to a local government for the purposes of this committee, it's primarily cities, counties, towns, and then specific political subdivisions that within the discretion of the chair and the members that they want to hear in front of this committee. For example, in the last biennium, there was a bill related to the Ramsey County Soil and Water Conservation District and its structuring that came before the committee. So that part will vary, but cities, counties, and towns primarily, and the regional government. One of the first things I like to highlight for those new to local government law in Minnesota is that we're what they call a Dillon's Rule State. And what that means is that local governments have the powers and duties that are given to them in law by the state, and those powers that are necessarily implied by an express grant of authority. Some states start with the premise that local governments have power and then the legislature takes it away. So sometimes I get the question, you know, where does it say that the city cannot do X, Y, and Z? The question that you have to ask is, where is the express authority to do X, Y, and Z? So you start with, where does it say you can do it? There are two things in law that, as I like to put it, mitigate that severity of that rule. One is that cities have the authority to establish home rule charters, which are essentially constitutions for the city. And out of the 853 cities in the state, 107 are home rule charter cities. And it doesn't matter what size they are. They're very small cities that are home rule charter. And then the first class cities are also a home rule charter. So it's not a size issue. It's a decision by the local unit of government, by the city, to adopt a charter or not. The other cities are called statutory cities, which means that their powers and duties come from state statute. Another general statute that gives greater authority or broader authority to cities and towns is the power to enact ordinances that protect the general health, safety, and welfare of the cities and towns. Counties don't actually have general welfare authority. They have some powers under the health law statutes for protecting health that sometimes things can be tucked into, for example, nuisance ordinances. But primarily, cities and towns have the authority to enact ordinances that they can couch in the terms of we're protecting the health, safety, and welfare of their residents. The other thing that is that you'll see in front of the committee, and in particular anything that might go to the local government subcommittee, are bills that are special laws. That's one way of thinking, special legislation for local government. And that's where you have a bill where the bill is either granting authority or requiring a specific unit of government to do something or have some power. And the state constitution requires that if it's a a bill that is a special law for an individual unit of government must be approved by that unit of government unless general law, state statute, provides an exception to that. And in state statute, in Chapter 645, there are some provisions that say that if the special law is bringing the unit of government into conformance with general law, you don't need local approval, repealing a special law, or if it's for a unit of government with a population of more than 1 million in population. So, for example, that would cover things like the Metropolitan Council, which is a political subdivision with more than 1 million population within its jurisdiction. Since the last census, also includes Hennepin County. Hennepin County is over 1 million in population, so it's now under that jurisdiction. But if a bill is granting authority to a specific unit of government, it does not require local approval. So if it's permissive, and there are many ways to draft laws to, so if you're working on something that is essentially a special law for unit of individual unit of government, I'm happy to talk through those options with you of how something can be drafted to accomplish your purposes. I'm trying to think of some of the general things that have come before the committee in the past relating to the powers and duties. It's things like the Uniform Municipal Contracting Law, exercise of joint powers, anything that's creating a new special purpose district that may be of interest to the committee, not always, but sometimes it is, land use planning and zoning issues, anything to do with municipal boundary adjustments, annexation, detachment, concurrent annexation and detachment or consolidation, and then questions relating to open meeting law that affect local units of government, and in some bienniums, it might include eminent domain. So there are a lot of different topics that can affect local governments, and I've found myself looking in just about every volume of statute at times. So the type of things that do not come typically before this committee that are of great interest to local governments are things that are very specific to transportation, for example, or health and human services. Those are handled in those committees typically. So. And with that, if the other thing I wanted to mention, in the memo there are some references to various publications that our office has that go into greater detail on some of these topics, and if you want more information on any of them. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just have two other sort of brief things to mention. One is, as Deb mentioned, in local government, she often is referring to many volumes of statutes, and they can be sometimes hard to find. That's also true of state government stuff. This is a committee where, in some committees, there's just like a little universe of a few chapters that they're responsible for, and you can all just like bring that volume with you, and you can see all the laws that are within that committee's jurisdiction. GovOps isn't quite that way. So one thing I put together, I don't think it's in your packet, but I can give it to you if anyone would like it, is I put together a list of like frequently requested GovOps laws. This helps you kind of navigate if you're someone who likes to read statutes and figure out kind of for yourself how things work. I can send this around. Just to help you kind of find common things, and that includes specific provisions related to rulemaking, pension stuff, public employees, but also some of the more obscure kind of random things that people sometimes get really interested in, like where do you find the list of state symbols, like the state muffin and the state soil and all those kinds of things. People ask for that with some regularity, and so that's also on this list. So I'm happy to send this around as needed. And then one other thing, in addition to the work that we do as committee staff, our office also plays a role as counsel for the House as a certain institution. And one thing I just want to remind you, because you might get questions from your colleagues about this, I gave a similar reminder to the State Government Division this morning. The Legislative Salary Council is meeting right now. This is the Constitution Amendment that was adopted and ratified in 2016. They're required to meet every odd numbered year to set salaries for legislators. And one aspect of that council's, the law that governs that council, is that legislators are prohibited from communicating with members of the council while they're deliberating. So I'd encourage you, because you're the Government Operations Committee, you might get questions from your colleagues about how that process works. Just remind them that trying to send email or communicate or phone call or anything, even if you happen to know personally the people who are on that council, is not a good idea until March while they're deliberating, because it's a violation of the statute that governs that council. So just keep that in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring and Ms. Dyson. And Mr. Gehring, I think if you could maybe if you have that document, the handout with the different laws relevant to GovOps, maybe send that to COCO, the CLA here, and then she can forward it to committee members electronically and post it on the committee website for the public as well. I think that would be very helpful for people to see. Members, do you have any questions for either Ms. Dyson or Mr. Gehring? Well, I have a few, so maybe it'll make members think of them. I do think it's worth going into a little bit more detail about the mandatory jurisdiction, the three areas where there is mandatory jurisdiction for this committee, just because we will hear so many bills because of this provision in the House rules here. So I have a question about each of the three areas. So maybe I'll just start with the first one. So any bill that, you know, under Part A, any bill that creates and establishes a department, an agency, a board, a task force, advisory committee, is required to go to the Government Operations Committee. And what that looks like in practice sometimes is that there's a very large bill covering a very, oftentimes a very serious, influential topic, say, you know, something related to health care. You know, it could be a 100-page long bill, and then there, buried at the end, is like a two-sentence provision establishing a task force to evaluate the, you know, to discuss the implementation of the law and report back to the legislature within a year. So, under this rule, that bill, even though it's mostly deals with health care, has to get referred to this committee. You know, what guidelines should our committee use when considering that bill? And just because, I mean, you know, generally, you know, for the benefit of the new members, I think, you know, we're often advised that only the task force provision is what should be discussed as a committee. Could you talk about how previous committees have handled issues like that, particularly with complex legislation that often only may have one small task force provision?
Mr. Chair, so typically the way that committee chairs in the past have handled this is that before the committee hearing, the chair will kind of either announce as part of the hearing or will announce by email that there are specific provisions of the bill that are specifically within the jurisdiction of this committee, and then it's kind of up to the chair to decide, you know, how much of a leash you want to give to have testimony and discussion about other aspects of the bill. Sometimes with task forces and advisory groups, that the substance of the group is just like inherently part of the thing, and so it's hard to talk in the abstract about like open meetings law when you have all sorts of other things going on. So that it kind of varies depending on how the bill is drafted. I have a checklist. I didn't bring it with, but maybe what I'll do is I'll bring it or send it to the CA for the first time you have one of these bills, that is sort of a checklist, like things to look for in the bill just to verify that the group is structured correctly. One of the things that that can happen is that, as I mentioned, kind of in the substantive committee that is really interested in healthcare policy, they can sometimes be, they correctly so, like their jurisdiction is to focus on the healthcare policy itself, and they can have very passionate and emotional testimony about how it's really important that this task force exists to deal with this particular problem, and in that setting, it's really hard to then say like, oh well, you know, it seems like a really great idea, but like, don't you think that these people should get like a mileage reimbursement or something? And then that kind of takes away from the gravity of the substance that they're considering. So that's the role of this committee, is to ask those kinds of questions and to make sure that the thing that's being proposed can get off the ground properly. And so it's kind of within the jurisdiction of the chair to kind of set the boundaries of what the testimony and discussion will be and to highlight the specific sections in a bill that you're going to hear.
Yeah. Thank you. And then on Part B, you know, I know you said you could do a whole presentation on rulemaking at another time. I mean, just, you know, it's not always an aspect of law that people are super familiar with. You know, can you maybe sort of explain? I mean, when an agency issues a rule, it has the force of law, and, you know, there are statutes. There's a whole chapter of the Administrative Procedures Act explaining what safeguards they're in to ensure there's public comment on it and to ensure that there's accountability. Can you maybe just sort of, I don't know, do a two-minute, just a little more detail on how rules work and what, you know, what we should look for in this committee when there are bills that relate to rulemaking?
Sure. Mr. Chair, this is again a topic that I can, when you get your first rulemaking bill, I could put together kind of a checklist of things to think about as you look at that bill. But in generally, the way that rulemaking works is that agencies are only authorized to adopt rules if you specifically let them do that by law, because they are in effect adopting policies that have the force and effect of law. So the legislature, as the lawmaking body of the state, has the authority to say, this agency, yes, you can adopt rules on this particular thing, or no, you can't adopt rules on this particular thing. We want all this stuff that you're going to work on to come through the legislative process, because we're the ones, the legislature is the ones with the election certificates that sets policy for the state. So part of what you're doing when you hear rulemaking bills is making that judgment about whether you want to delegate some sort of authority to the agency to adopt rules that have the force and effect of law, or if you want that power to stay within the legislative branch. And that's an important balancing thing that really depends on the context of the bill. The other thing that you're looking for in a rulemaking bill is, as the chair mentioned, how much time is going to take the agency to adopt the rule, and how much public input you want to provide. And there are separate, there are different procedures in the Chapter 14, which is our rulemaking chapter, that set out standards depending on the type of rule and how quickly it needs to be adopted. So sort of what would be sort of like a standard rulemaking procedure requires the agency first to submit a notice where they can take the agency will say, you know, we're thinking about adopting rules on this particular thing. Members of the public can then like write in comments and say, you know, oh, if you're going to do rules on that topic, like, why don't you consider this aspect? So I'm trying to think of a recent example, like the Campaign Finance Board went through this process a couple of years ago where they were going to make some Campaign Finance Board rules, and they sent out a notice saying, you know, we're going to generally take a look at some rules related to independent expenditures, and they had to take public comments, suggestions from people about how they might structure those rules. Then after that period is done, then what happens next is that the agency actually drafts actual rules, so they work with the revisor's office to put the rules into what looks like a bill, and then those rules get published, and there's a second period for public comment that happens after that where people can react to the actual language that's written down, and depending on the complexity of the rule, then the rules also may have a public hearing where the agency has to go before an administrative law judge and sort of defend the rules, and there's almost like a judicial proceeding where people can come in and make comments in that venue. And then what happens after that is then that the administrative law judge is responsible for looking through the rules, looking at the documentation the agency submits to verify that the rules as written are consistent with the legislative authority to adopt the rules, and that the agency submits what's called a statement of need and reasonableness. It's called a SONAR, where they explain why they feel the rules are necessary. The administrative law judge reviews that and then decides whether to approve the rules as written or whether to suggest changes. And so that sort of back and forth process can happen over a period of several months. And then eventually you get to a place at the end where the rules are finally adopted and published, and then they have force and effect of law. So that's a process that can take many months up to many years, depending on how complicated the rule is. And that's the sort of the standard process. But there are other procedures, and this is part of what this committee does, is to look at what procedures an agency is required to go through to adopt rules. There are procedures that are intended to be faster and more efficient, and the balance is that you allow the agency to go through rulemaking more quickly, but then what you cut out is the additional opportunities for substantial public comment. So in some cases, you might want an agency to be able to react quickly to sort of like an emerging health threat or something. So an example of this would be like the DNR dealing with like chronic wasting disease, or dealing with a swine flu that was going through farms a few years ago. So they need to be able to adopt rules quickly to like react to that, and don't necessarily have the time to have 2 years worth of public comment about what those rules should be. So instead, what you'd authorize is the agency to go through either an expedited process or an emergency process or a good. So the official titles are expedited, emergency, good cause, exempt, or not a rule. Those are all different procedures that apply to agencies depending on the context, and each of those have different factors that require certain levels of public input and certain levels of review from the administrative law judge, but it's not the full-blown rulemaking process that would take quite a bit of time. And so when you hear of these bills in front of you, you're deciding whether the agency has sufficient time to accomplish the policy objective while also going through the rulemaking process.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. That's helpful. And finally, on Part C, you know, within the committee's jurisdiction, is any any proposal that substantially changes the organization of a department or agency of state government. And there's a little more there. But every time I see a word like substantially or reasonably, I kind of wonder how is that term defined? Can you just maybe talk a little bit about how that's, you know, how that's been treated in the past by this committee, and what is considered to be substantially changing the makeup of a department or agency?
So, Mr. Chair, that's another rule that does allow some discretion for the committee chair to decide what a substantial effect on an agency is. So you'll have some ability yourself to kind of make judgment calls about particular bills, and we often in our office will do some advising back and forth on particular bills. I often, with both majorities and CAs, have taken calls where we look through a bill and say, oh, you know, is this a substantial change or not? We kind of go back and forth, and sometimes there are bills that are kind of in a gray area, and it's just a judgment call for you to decide whether the bill should be referred, or it's a judgment call for the House as a whole to decide whether to refer a bill through an action on the floor to this committee. Generally, there's not a hard and fast definition or rule about what that means, but generally, things that, you know, the example I gave was the transfer of the SHPO office from the Historical Society to admin. That's it's physically picking up an office and moving it to like another department of state government. So that's a pretty substantial change in government operations. So that's the kind of thing that would come here. There are smaller offices where that type of thing happens that also would likely come here. If you're creating a new office of some kind, that would come here. But it's really, it's hard to sort of talk in the abstract. You really have to kind of see a bill in front of you and see the context and make a judgment call about whether something is a substantial change or not.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for? Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gehring, how often does the legislature review rulemaking authority, task forces, commissions, even departments, and either repeals, takes away, and says, you know, this task force hasn't met in 20 years, yet it's still in the books? How often do we do that?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, so that's an authority of this committee in some sense. There used to be what was called the Sunset Commission that was specifically established to go through all the agencies and all the task forces and all the things to decide whether they were still necessary or not. That commission was repealed and ultimately chose not to to eliminate any organizations.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but this tends to be a pile-on committee. We add more. We don't review or audit what we have added. In 2014, Dayton had what he termed an un-session, which we turned into an un-plus session. And I remember reviewing hundreds of pages of obsolete task forces, commissions, and everything else, only to have people come out of the woodwork and say, even though it hadn't met in 20 years, you can't repeal it because who knows, it might need to meet. So I would suggest in this committee that might want to consider, at least in some fashion, instead of putting bills in to continue to add more, maybe we should seriously consider what we have and what is useless and obsolete and out of date, and repeal, take away, stamp on it, stomp on it. And that's not his, Mr. Gehring, you don't have to respond to this.
Representative Pawlowski.
Chairman, when we have 400 and some bills, the majority of which are only making things worse, I shouldn't say that.
Representative Pawlowski, you're going to be a treat to have on this committee. I do know at some point in the last session, I think possibly as a joke, there was an amendment offered to create a task force on task forces.
Maybe members on the floor yesterday that had task forces. By the way, it was not of this party, which I refuse to sign on to. But, Mr. Chair, this gets to a point where you're looking at a committee that basically wants to do more when what we have is at least considerably dysfunctional in some areas and needs to be reviewed and changed and amended or repealed. This is the 21st century. We have things on the books, I don't want to say from what century, but certainly they don't need to be continually on the books. It would be interesting if a state agency, for instance, came in front of us and said, instead of here's what I need to do on top of what I already have, they would balance it and say, here's what we should repeal, and then here's what we should add on to what is absolutely necessary, or change, frankly. So, Mr. Chair, that's just a suggestion, but I would say if we're hearing 200 and some bills that are introduced, I know a chair that heard considerably less when he was chairing. And and actually passed even less than that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying it as a joke, because this isn't funny anymore. We have clogged bills, and I'll repeat a number I'd like to repeat. Last session we had 4,542 bills. I actually had 4,541 until the chair said I missed one, and I had to add it, which I still appreciate the chair doing that. At some point, we have to stop and take a look at what's there. And if it isn't working, repeal it, take it away, and consider a balanced approach to this. That's a suggestion, Mr. Chair.
Might be time for an unsession number two. So, Representative Quam and then Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my esteemed colleague. If you want a partner working on that, I remember and I recall the deliberations and activities of the Sunset Commission, and also many of the items. I mean, I'm not sure if there's a buggy whip and a Stanley Steamer entity out there anymore, but you know, frankly, there are a lot of things that we could put our abacuses away, pull out our apps on our phones, and maybe make government a little bit more efficient, so that we can have that savings of money and effort and time put to what our citizens need. And I like your purple you're wearing. A golfer should be wearing a green jacket with the ideas that you're coming up with and proposing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, I remember the unsession when an agency, which I will not name, came before a committee I won't name, or a chair I won't name, but who I'm very familiar with an unsession bill. It was several hundred pages long. We met upstairs in the legislative library, the Senate staffer and chair, my staff person and chair, and we went through it. We had to eliminate half of the unsession pages because half of the pages added while the other half supposedly took away. But the kicker at the end was the establishment of a task force, a new task force, so that we could appoint people to a task force, which, by the way, we ripped out of the bill. My caution is this. When the agencies come before us, read the entire bill. I would suggest, Mr. Chair, you sit down with the agency in advance with your staff. You take a close look at what's in that bill. And I say that with the Secretary of State. Usually the Secretary of State has a house cleaning bill, and we have to go in there with a vacuum and clean that bill up. So you've got to be very careful when these bills are proposed. And we shouldn't even let them come to the committee until we've reviewed them and actually seen what's in them. So, Mr. Chair, this does get to be serious, and you've seen the last few sessions. I think we should spend a great deal of our time doing less, not more.
I remember Representative O'Driscoll, who chaired this committee last session, liked to say, well, I didn't hear a question there, so I'll go to the next, provided that's okay. So I can kind of see why he said that now that I'm sitting here in this chair. So I'll go to Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would hope that Representative Pulaski would introduce that bill long before we hit the 1,000 mark and leave a couple of spots open for us over here on this side.
Mr. Chair, therein lies the flaw. We don't need to introduce a bill. We need to take a look at what's there now. We have so many members who think the solution to every problem is the introduction of a bill. That is not the solution. The solution is to take a look at what's there now and then work in committee to make sure there's less. A bill is very often not the solution, but working on, for instance, the budgets and the way these agencies and commissions and task forces have been set up, that's the solution, not the introduction of a bill. And by the way, purple, the purple goes all the way back to at least the Roman Republic, where carved all over our buildings and in the front of the speaker's rostrum is something called a fasces, which is, it looks like an axe with elm rods. The elm rods, and there were only two offices in the Roman Republic that had the power of imperium and purple that could punish and the axe to execute. And if we're going to talk about purple, I think this committee should perhaps start executing some things instead of passing.
I was worried you were going to say executing some people rather than some things. Okay, I don't see any other questions, so thank you, Mr. Gehring. Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Appreciate your wealth of knowledge here. I've also asked to hear from the Department of Administration today, so if they could step forward, please. And if you could please identify yourself for the record before beginning your testimony, we would appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I am Alice Roberts-Davis, Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and I am joined today by Katie Knutson, our Legislative Director. Thank you so much for the opportunity to provide a brief overview of the Department of Administration for you this morning. Since 1939, admin has handled state government's core business functions, allowing other agencies to deliver their core services directly to Minnesotans. You're already familiar with a lot of the work that we do. Our teams oversaw the restoration of the Capitol, and admin team members clean your offices at night and are also here at 3 a.m. in the morning to shovel the sidewalks. But there's a lot of work done by the department that you may not be aware of. For example, we insure the state's vehicles and property against liability, and we negotiate the contracts that allow for low prices based on volume purchases. Admin is a diverse agency that serves Minnesotans in a wide variety of ways, and so I'll jump right in. Admin's mission is to benefit all Minnesotans by leading innovation, creating solutions, and providing exceptional service. Our values and goals are based on the principles of diversity and inclusion, customer satisfaction, and technology optimization, just to name a few. Our mission and vision direct the work of our 544 employees and 24 divisions throughout the agency. Our agency, again, is very diverse in both the services we provide and the customers we serve. Take a technology break.
Sorry, minor technological issue.
So as I mentioned earlier, admin provides services to agencies so that they are better able to deliver their core programs. We handle the state's procurements so that the Department of Education, for example, can focus on educating Minnesota's children and not on negotiating contracts. We also provide services directly to Minnesotans. For example, there are individuals with autism across the state who can now more easily communicate with public safety officers in the event of an emergency due to the technology that the office has helped create. Looking more closely at the services we provide to agencies, the Facilities Management Division maintains and operates 22 state-owned buildings, including the state capitol, 32 parking facilities, 25 monuments, and the associated grounds. The division also coordinates events on the Capitol complex and oversees the administration of Minnesota's bookstore, the State Register, and Central Mail. Real Estate and Construction Services, or RECS, manages more than 400 construction projects and administers 800 property leases annually. Overall, the state has a real property footprint that includes roughly 6,200 buildings and 5.5 million square feet of owned and leased property. The Enterprise Real Property Program is a team of just two who manage 19 state agencies that have custodial ownership of real property. This team has trained each agency on a consistent way to assess property so that we have a common language to describe the building condition and prioritize building maintenance needs across the enterprise. This assessment process is how we have determined that the state has the need for $850 million in catch-up on deferred building maintenance. The Office of State Procurement oversees more than $2 billion in purchasing of goods and services annually. The division negotiates low pricing based on volume purchasing and manages about 1,600 enterprise contracts. In addition, they lead the two largest cooperative purchasing programs in the nation. One is MCAP, which negotiates contracts for pharmaceuticals, and the other is our own cooperative purchasing venture, which allows more than 1,300 of Minnesota's cities, counties, and school districts to benefit from the state's low negotiated pricing. Within the Office of State Procurement, the Office of Equity and Procurement helps ensure greater equity in state contracting. They work with business owners who are women, minorities, veterans, people with substantial physical disabilities, and those who live in economically disadvantaged counties of the state. They assist them in bidding on state contracts, and this office, established in 2015, by 2018 had increased spend with black-owned businesses by more than 2,000%, and with indigenous-owned businesses by 1,500%. The Procurement Technical Assistance Center is a partially federally funded program that provides one-on-one counseling to any Minnesota business interested in contracting with federal, state, or local government. And they also conduct and attend more than 75 outreach events each year to educate businesses on how to compete for government contracts. The Office of Enterprise Sustainability was established in 2016, and in 2017, the office produced its inaugural sustainability report. This report was the result of the gathering and analysis of more than 1.5 million data points. The information in this report will serve as a baseline for each agency as they work toward the goal of reducing the state's carbon footprint. The office will continue to provide guidance and resources to each agency around this work. So as I mentioned, admin has 24 diverse divisions. They're all listed here, and I'm happy to answer questions, but in the interest of time, I won't walk through each of them individually. I would, however, like to call out the Small Agency Resource Team, also known as SMART, which provides accounting, budgeting, and human resources services to the state's small agencies, boards, and councils. They are very small operations, and SMART services assist them by navigating the complexities of the state system, which allows them to continue to focus on their core work. If we then pivot to the services that we offer to all Minnesotans, again, there are many, but I'll just call out a few. The first would be the State Demographic Center, which analyzes and interprets demographic data and shares it with the public. They're also Minnesota's official liaison with the U.S. Census Bureau for the 2020 census, and so their work is in full bore. Finally, the open meeting law requires public bodies to follow certain rules when conducting business in meetings. The Data Practices Office weighs in with informal advice and technical assistance to government, public, media, and the legislature. The office also provides training statewide and online. Now, I understand that this is not a budget overview, but I think that understanding how we are funded will provide better context for the agency's operations. So quickly, admin's biennial budget is largely comprised of internal services funds, which are funds that we receive for services that we provide directly to agencies. We also have funds in special revenue accounts and receive a small amount of federal gifts and money. Our general fund is split almost exactly in half, with half being passed through directly to recipients and the other half going to agency operations. I'll do a quick deeper dive into how the general fund operating budget is spent. The general fund operating budget is dispersed across 15 divisions, making up only 6% of our total budget. It's a very small but critical component to providing the breadth and quality of our enterprise services. So with that overview, I thank you for your time this morning. I look forward to working with all of you this session, and I'm happy to stand for any questions you may have about the Department of Administration.
Thank you, Commissioner Roberts Davis. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You cover a lot of support for buildings and real estate and real property. Is there ever a study of utilization and occupancy across that so that we have an idea of how we're using those assets?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
Commissioner. We
do study usage, and one of the goals of the agency is to look at opportunities for co-location and co-tenancy among agencies so that we can create efficiencies between agencies that have similar services or similar missions whenever possible.
Representative Quam?
Mr. Chair, you've got 3.5% on continuous improvement. What have been the savings or the productivity gains from that initiative?
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have had some extremely large projects that the Office of Continuous Improvement has assisted with over the past year. The efficiencies that they're able to create and the way that they're able to work with the agencies to help them streamline their operations is really what we call out as the savings for those agencies.
Representative Quam?
Well, maybe offline she can actually give data instead of the verbal imagery. But it'd be a nice idea to see how this is leveraging for school districts and other entities and how they can improve their operations. There have been a lot of gains, I guess, from creative groups, and it'd be nice if we could cross-pollinate that around. When I was on the school board, I'm familiar with where you'd go out have an aggregate purchasing and get good deals on some equipment, but it'd be nice if there was a little bit more of a feedback loop, so what the different districts might be interested in could be on the list instead of, so maybe those kind of operations, offline, if you can give us a little bit of backstory.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm happy to do that. I do have some figures around the actual efficiencies that we created, but not the savings, so I'm happy to pull that together.
Okay. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last question. And the first thing I did that became law was SAVVY, which was basically if an agency or campus of a university, college, et cetera, found a way of saving and not spending the money instead of, we got to spend all our money. Half the money goes back to the general fund. The other half goes into an account that they can then utilize, to further their mission. And it's a win-win because they get, I was at a union meeting with college instructors, and they were complaining about having to form the committee that, spend the money before we lose it. And they wish they could spend it on what they wanted. It'd be nice to understand what type of things that they utilize those savings for and spend it on, so we can maybe feed that back, and the people that actually do the work in our agencies, what they see as the need, as opposed to we sit here and say, use this money on that. So that's sunsetting. But it'd be nice if we had the feedback so that we can more intelligently adjust the bills to give our workers in the agencies what they actually need instead of what we perceive that they need. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lee and then Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you just tell us a little bit about the Office of Grants Management and what kind of grants do they manage and who are some of the grantees, I guess.
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, the Office of Grants Management works in partnership with more than 30 state agencies and organizations to standardize, streamline, and improve state grant-making practices and increase public information around state grant opportunities. I don't have an actual listing with me today of who some of the grant recipients are, but I'm happy to provide that to you.
Okay. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you also manage the Office of Enterprise Sustainability. Can you tell us a little bit about how far the other agencies are going towards that, and if you have a number of how much that have saved the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner Robert Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I actually have copies of the sustainability report that I'm happy to leave here for anyone who's interested in reading more about it. One of the wonderful things about this is that there's actually an agency report card in the back of the report, which shows exactly where each agency is today.
The other thing that we're rolling out is a sustainability tool that will be online, and it will give a running tracking number of how much money is being saved by the state based on the initiatives that we are putting in place through the Office of Enterprise Sustainability. So all of that information is public, transparent, and available.
And it looks like our pages are handing out copies. Looks like. Thank you for bringing copies. Representative Lee? Okay. You're welcome. Representative Gomez?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm just wondering if you can tell me a little bit more about the pass-through funding that comes from the general fund. And you just said that it goes to recipients, and maybe I'm supposed to know what that means, but I don't know what that means.
Sure.
Thank you.
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have some notes here on exactly what pass-throughs go to. And pass-throughs are for FY 20 and 21, approximately $27 million. Those monies go for public broadcasting, both radio and television, the in lieu of rent, WCRA, which is workers' compensation, and then also the SHPO tax credit, which is the State Historic Preservation Office.
Representative Gomez?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Pawlowski.
Commissioner, did I hear correctly when you stated there was $800 million in deferred maintenance?
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative, yes, that's correct.
Representative Pawlowski.
Commissioner, can you give some examples of what you mean by deferred maintenance?
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we actually have a full report that I'm happy to get to you, but it goes through each of the 19 custodial agencies have gone through and looked at their facilities and assessed them so that we have a common understanding of what is considered disrepair for each building. And in that report, it shows roof, HVAC, structural, all of those elements of the building and what state of repair they're in for each building.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, thank you. Where does deferred maintenance rank when you present your budget?
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are working directly with the Governor's office on our budget requests, and we have asked previously for monies for deferred maintenance because we know that this is critical to ensuring that the buildings that we're operating in are safe and comfortable for people who work and visit the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Pawlowski. Commissioner, I appreciate your answer, but that's not my question. My question is, where does it rank? Why isn't it number one? Why aren't we saying that we need, if you have a leaky roof, I went through the Ford building a couple times this session already. I don't even know why we call it a building since the elements seem to come into the building just as much as the elements are outside. So why isn't it number one, and that should be the first thing that we take care of?
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, last year in the session, we did raise deferred maintenance as a high item for the agency. We called a lot of attention, elevated that conversation, and there was not funding provided for deferred maintenance last session.
Representative Pawlowski.
Maybe if the agency elevated it to number one and then told us exactly, when you have a leaky roof, it isn't just the roof that leaks. It's the damage inside the building that's equally has to be repaired and sometimes multiplies the problem that we have by factors of 10 or more. So I realize this isn't a budget committee, but when you bring it up in a presentation here and we're $800 million in deferred maintenance and you're just one agency, this is a huge problem, mm-hmm. and it should be your number one priority to fix what is already broken.
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the $850 million with the Department of Administration being the enterprise leader for that, that is the enterprise number. That's not just for our agency. But it is something that we have raised as a critical issue for ensuring that the buildings are safe and habitable.
Representative Pawlowski. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question is how we're bringing innovation and efficiency into Department of Admin. And the background is, I remember being on capital investment and looking at projects, and we would go out and look at some that were in excess of $550 to $600 a square foot, and we'd look at others that were under $300 a square foot. They were both classroom-type things. And I'm not disputing that some classrooms cost more than others, but how are we bringing innovation into the department so that we're looking at what should be spent, because I agree that the deferred maintenance is a tax on the people, because when we're not doing that, sooner or later somebody's going to have to pay for it, and it's an ongoing liability whether it's recognized on the balance sheet or not. So what we need to do is use the assets that we have, the money that we have, as efficiently as possible. So the question is, what type of innovative efficiency cost investigative structures have you put in place so that we realize that we're getting the best value possible, and that what's being spec'd out actually needs to be spec'd out and couldn't be possibly cost reduced if it was done in a different way?
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would suggest that the ArcaBus system that we put in place at the Department of Administration is the innovation that you're requesting information about. What we do with that system is, again, look at every building as an apples-to-apples comparison so that we're able to prioritize across the enterprise what projects need to be completed first. That's something that hasn't happened historically, and it also gives us a common language to talk about the deferred maintenance projects that need to happen. So using technology has really been the way that we've been innovative in looking at this problem.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up then. You know, to me, it's about looking at how do we have to operate in the future. We may not be able to replace granite with granite or walnut with walnut. And that's the real question I'm asking is, how are we being innovative so that not only are we looking at this spec that's before us, but bringing in people that objectively look at it and say, do we need this spec? Is there a way that we could provide the resource to the people, whether it's education or anything else, less costly? And one of the reasons I say that, too, is when I was on the Scott County Board, I remember we were doing the Law Enforcement Center. And they had burnished block in there rather than painted block. And by the time they got done looking at it, they both served the same purpose, but one was a whole lot less expensive, although not as aesthetically pleasing. Mm-hmm. That's the type of innovation I'm talking about in the systems and process that would bring that to your department, possibly with some outside objective information from people that may not even be in the department.
Commissioner Robert Savis.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that, Representative. We do look at options every time we're doing remodels and maintenance to buildings. We're looking at the most efficient way to make those changes in the building. We'll continue to do that.
Thank you. Any other questions for members? I have one. Just, Commissioner, you mentioned the small agency resource team. I think you said it was called SMART.
Yeah.
It said it provides assistance to small boards and council and councils that may not be staffed. I was just wondering, you know, since we've already talked about the number of task forces and advisory councils and so forth out there, I assume does the department kind of track all of those and which agencies and boards are out there, how often they meet, that type of information? Would it be possible to see a copy of that information?
Mr. Chair, yes, we'd be happy to provide more information.
Okay. Great, thank you. Members, Representative Bonner.
I'm sorry, I got missed, but I want to backtrack for one moment. When we were talking about that deferred maintenance, and I realize that there's a sensitivity because, of course, we are in a budget year, and we're talking about trying to fund some of those particular items. So here is my question. As a list of those things, and we've taken that inventory of what all those things are that require maintenance, has there been any level of prioritization done among those items? So, for example, in a budget year, if we say, I'm sorry, we can't fund $150 million all at once, while we'd love to do that, is there some prioritization level that we might be able to identify some of those more critical projects? So if it comes down to, making those hard decisions from a budgetary perspective, that we can have that option to at least address things like a leaky roof that will cause further damage or disrepair first and make sure that those get funded.
Commissioner Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the ArcaBus system is able to prioritize projects for us, and it ranks them by critical, poor, good, fair condition, and so we're able to look across the enterprise and see which projects are most critical and prioritize them in that way.
Representative Bonner?
And is there anywhere where we could get a breakdown of what that looks like by cost and by area?
Commissioner Robert Savis?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I'm happy to get that.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Representative Mason, actually, could you start by just identifying yourself, too? So since we did do introductions.
Okay. Sandra Mason from District 51A, which is most of Western Eagan, all of Northern Burnsville. And I just, I don't know how long you've been with the department, but in my belief, the Capitol should have been done decades ago. So just out of curiosity, for like maybe since 80s and beyond, how were you rating the Capitol until it was done?
Commissioner Robert Savis?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I've been with the agency for 3 years, and so the Capitol restoration is a project that predates me. The Capitol was never actually in the Arquebus system. The Arquebus system is probably only about 3 to 4 years old, and so it would not have had a rating at that point in time. But you know, obviously, the disrepair of the building spoke for itself in that situation.
Representative Mason?
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Salk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question really is about nomenclature across all these units that we do get to hear at one time or another. I sat on capital investment last year, and they're talking about building ratings and all of these kinds of things. And you're an enterprise reporter, so I guess a couple simplistic. I'm just a farmer kid, so maybe I don't get it. But when you say enterprise ratings on buildings with an $850 million shortfall, is that including University of Minnesota, Minnesota State? And I can go down the list of all of what I consider to be the state's enterprise.
Commissioner Robert Savis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that number is exclusive of the state of Minnesota and other universities. I'm sorry, the University of Minnesota and other state universities. Not included in the number.
Right.
Representative Salk.
Thank you very much. Just to continue again, because I think now I'm just going to underline the critical nature of this is. One of the things we wander around is do these very siloed activities. We talk about something here, and then we talk about something over here, and we talk about, and we go from one, and we think we solved that one, and then we go to another, and oh, we don't have enough money. The fact is we should have been talking about the whole animal so that we actually knew that we were drawing lines or drawing values that reflect on the state across where I live as well as where Representative Nash lives. You know, we have assets all over, and if we are starting to just play a little bit of three-card Monty, and I know that's a pejorative way of saying it, but just, you know, we're talking about this one now, and now we're going to talk about this one over here, but it'll be something else, but we're going to use the same rating system. My brain gets a little muddled in that, and I've got another word for it. I call it kabuki theater. But so can you just reflect on what I've offered?
Commissioner Robert Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the thing that we're excited about with the Arquebus system is, again, the people who are in that office are working directly with each of the 19 custodial agencies to train them on how to look at the buildings, assess them, so we all have a common understanding of what constitutes fair condition, what constitutes critical condition, what constitutes good condition, and that allows us to look at them across the entire enterprise and make apples-to-apples comparisons.
Representative Salk?
And again, you just used the magic word. To me, the enterprise is every state-owned facility in the state.
Right.
And I know that you didn't mean it that way when you said enterprise in your last two sentences or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a pathway for us to get to that place, or to have reporting that says this is using the real world, real word enterprise, as opposed to just my office, the enterprise that of the building that I go in and out of, that kind of thing?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did work with the university and the other state universities on their assessments as well. We have the number that encompasses all of the entire enterprise, and I'm happy to share that with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner Roberts Davis. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Ms. Knudsen, for being here. So Thursday we will be hearing from the state auditor, and we will be hearing the election bills. The I believe an earlier version of the agenda had suggested that the Legislative Commission's on pensions would be scheduled.